Hey, it's Aaron back here with Jim for another Bald Move Commission podcast. If you don't know what the hell we're talking about the Commission podcast, you can find out how to do that at baldmove.com/shop. This one is pulled down by Tim Michael, a native Australian with Australia's Own 2011 Animal Kingdom, directed by David Michaud.
My code. I have no idea.
It's
how
got
to say
a
that.
Couple umlauts.
It's French.
Helpless.
He's Australian.
It's an ossified French name. I'm helpless before its power. But it's excellent. I mean, we've had a lot of diamonds in the rough. I feel like calling it that is damning it with way too much faint praise. Like, I was blown away while watching this movie, to the extent that normally I'm taking notes when we're doing these commission podcasts while I'm watching the movie, you know, stuff I want to talk about. I realize, like, 40 minutes in, I completely, you know, I stopped taking notes like 10 minutes into the movie.
I never even wrote anything down. I was just captivated by it from the start. And, like, it was weird, too, because it was completely unexpected. I went into it not knowing anything about it.
Yep.
Other than, like, a very brief synopsis.
And here's
the
thing about titles. Like, I hear Animal Kingdom and I see Guy Pearce on the cover, and I'm like, nah. You know, like, okay. Literally, if someone hadn't paid me to watch this movie, I never, ever, ever would have watched it. And it's awesome. In fact, I want to, if you haven't seen this before, I really want to urge you to just stop right now and watch it, because as much as I like this movie, I think that it's one of those things where it's kind of an irreplaceable first watch. If you go in there completely blind, there's going to be some things that just kind of make you gasp. Not in, like, the Sixth Sense twist way, but just, you know, this movie's real.
Yeah, it's moody and it's deliberate, and it's a lot of the things that don't feel like I would really be captivated by, but
it's Australian crime film in the same way that, like, Goodfellas is a American crime film, and, like, Rock and Rolla is a British crime film. These things are kind of like, you know, this David McClure. I feel like he's hung his shingle out in the same way that, like, a Coppola or a Scorsese.
Yeah.
Or a Ritchie has done. Like, he could make films in this kind of universe, this gritty kind of Australian crime universe, and I will continue to watch them. I guess we should start actually talking about the film now that we've sufficiently said, for real, you can't see this on Netflix, but it's like $4 rent high def on Amazon or iTunes, and I encourage you to do that right now. Shut it off. We'll wait here for you.
Yeah, so it's made in 2010, released in 2010, and it's...
Oh, I thought it was a 2011. I fucked that up.
I think it's 2010.
It's what IMDb says, so I just totally fucked that up.
And I don't know what they've done since, but, I mean, this David guy is part of... I wouldn't call it a troupe, necessarily, but it's a group of friends who kind of grew up doing things together with, like, short films and stuff, and it's called the Blue Tongue. They're called Blue Tongue.
Really?
Whatever that is, yeah. So I don't know what else they've done together, but I kind of am interested in going back.
I was going to say, there's a bunch of films I've never seen before. The
Is
Rover,
there anything after
Bear.
This?
Yeah, those are two. Okay. The Rover just came out last year. Hesher, Netherland Dwarf. I Love Sarah Jane, Spider, Crossbow looks kind of cool.
I Love
These
Sarah
are
Jane,
shorts.
I heard, is like a zombie thing.
Oh, interesting. And they're all shorts, too. And so he was the writer for Netherland Dwarf, I Love Sarah Jane, and Spider. Director, his directing credits... is he directing War Machine? Is that a Marvel movie?
War Machine?
Yeah, it says it's a comedy, so I doubt it.
It's a movie about war gamers. I don't know.
Nothing Die for the Enlightened. There's a couple things. Yeah. So, whatever. Yeah, I definitely want to revisit this guy's work, because I think this was his directorial debut, and it was incredible.
Yeah, it was his first full-length feature film.
Most of the times when I'm doing research on these, I read the reviews, you know, and just kind of get the positive reviews. I actually went and drilled straight to the negative reviews, because I'm like, what am I missing?
It's kind of tough to find a really negative review of this film.
And the ones I did, I feel like, whether this movie works or not, I think hinges largely on what you think of the lead performance of Jay by James Freshfield.
Okay.
I think that's how you pronounce his name. Again, it's got a little Francophile stench on it. And I thought he played a teenager the way I think a teenager would behave in this situation where, you know, his mother is, you know, clearly some kind of drug addict and he's probably been neglected and hasn't had a whole lot of socialization. And now he's thrown into this crime family. In fact, there's this one line he has where he says, you know, I'm just a teenager. It's like, I didn't think I was doing anything incredible or anything unusual. This is just the place I was at. And this is what I was doing. And I thought, man, that is your teenage years to a T.
Like, it was certainly mine. Yeah.
If you're like a lower class income or status class teenager, then whatever town, whatever shit that the kids get up to in the town that you're in, and whatever, you know, wild hair the friends that you follow get up to, that's kind of what you do. It's not a statement of you as a person so much as the circumstances you find yourself in.
Sure.
And I thought that was really incredible. And he's like a powder keg, because I think if you check out on his performance halfway through the movie, you're not going to be open to, like, when the dam finally breaks.
Yeah, with Nikki.
Yeah, but it totally does. When he goes over to Nikki's family's house after she's dead and realizes all that, you know, I thought that was, again, exactly how I think a teenager his age and his circumstances would react.
Yeah, I found his, you know, lack of emotion in these different scenarios as completely plausible. Given the neglect that he must have experienced with his mother.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I was going to this and I'm thinking Australian movie, right? Oh my God, here we go. We're going to have,
it's going to be some ridiculous gay cowboy over uncle. The top.
Yeah. We just came off of, whatever that movie was called with Kate Winslet.
There's
going to
be some bad wigs, some questionable facial hair, some interesting fashion choices.
Sure. Just a lot of over the top behavior. And that wasn't true at all.
Yeah, no.
This is a much more like a personality, family focused movie.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that it focuses on a crime family.
Right.
And I kind of think it's brilliant that we don't see their crimes.
Yeah, no.
I think that takes the focus squarely away from the crimes themselves and puts it on the people.
It is. I think that's the other kind of critical take I saw a lot of. Well, not a lot of, but the five or six, you know, top critics that panned this. It's interesting because so this is like a 94% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, but I was a little scared because when we queued it up on Amazon, it had like a 3.7 user rating.
Out of five.
Yeah. And I'm like, you know, in Amazon, like if something's not rated above 4, it might as well just be garbage just because of the way the internet rates stuff. And I'm like, oh man, this is going to be an interesting flick. But no, I can see how a lot of people would watch this, and if you're not, if you don't have the right taste or the right maturity if you haven't built up, you know, if you haven't built up to like, you know, IPA beer type of taste in movies or like an espresso coffee taste, then this is probably going to taste bitter.
Or if you've been boring. Set up with like the wrong expectations, right?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a movie about a crime family.
Oh, yeah.
You go into it thinking
is going to be Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels in Australia.
Yeah, that's not what this is.
No,
not even close.
It is not that kind of entertaining.
No, but it is, I think the best word for it is captivating.
It's very watchable. It's a slow burn. It's very rare you see a 2-hour slow burn movie. But that actually works, and I think this one does. Damn, we're still not really talking about the movie.
Well, so what do you want to talk about? The plot? I mean, I was going to talk about, you know, how it uses violence.
Because that's the other thing, is like most of the crime dramas we've seen have been like inner city crime.
Yeah.
This is suburban crime. Like they meet in a fish store, for God's sakes. Like, I grew up around, you know, like Uncle Bill's Pet Shop. Like that's the place, man. And they're doing drug deals and meeting with police informants there. And I thought that was kind of quaint. And just kind of low stakes shit they get up to. Like, you know, dude cuts you off in traffic. So as a rite of passage, make Jay get out and confront him with a gun just for a giggle. Like that stuff is great.
So, you know, that low stakes angle is interesting because I never quite – in this film, I understand that this is a crime family and that maybe they're kind of, you know, not totally on their way out, but they're being hunted, obviously, by the police. And it seems like the stakes are getting lower and lower. Like, they're sliding out of power here.
Yeah.
Because there's some line where she mentions, like, oh, you know, the hauls we've been getting are like 9,000. Can you even afford to throw me a grand or something like that? And you get the sense that this is a family on decline.
Yes.
But both, you know, because they're being hunted, but also just crime doesn't pay as well as it did before. Their particular armed robbery brand.
At what point I wrote in my notes, oh, this is the rare criminal that gets out at just the right time.
Right.
And then you get, and then the next line says, nope, shotgun. It's hard to get out of the life of crime at the right time. But I feel like, yeah, they were very, but that's, I guess that's where I got sidetracked. The other criticism is people didn't understand where they were. Like, what is this family actually notorious for doing? And it's weird because, they're kind of bank robbers. They're kind of drug dealers. How much money do they have? How much? They've got one crooked cop. Are they like, you know, Michael Corleone powerful?
And that's the problem I had with it, too. You don't ever actually learn how powerful they were or are.
And as you said, as their family slides down in scale of power, somehow their reach throughout the movie seems like it gets like bigger and bigger. Like to the end where it's like, man, there is it's hard for me to believe that a low stakes kind of mid-level gangster family has access to some of the power that they are flexing towards the end of the film. But on the other hand, you can excuse a lot of that by just saying, well, you don't really know. And it's not super important to the plot.
That's true. And for me, it didn't feel necessarily like they had a lot of inroads. It really only felt like they had this one dirty cop, right? Who was at the fish store.
And when he staged that raid to, you know, on the witness protection program, that was a little bit of a reach for me.
I get it, but that wasn't, you know, the crime family didn't have anything to do with that other than saying, hey, if you don't get this guy out of here, you're going to be in trouble too. And then they just kind of let him take it. So,
True. So
really it's him that has the power to go stage this raid. Now, if they had said, okay, we're going to, you know, work our other contacts inside, and I don't know, it seemed like he was the one touchstone that they had inside the organization.
But nothing actually came of that either. Like, there didn't seem there was any consequences to it. But again, I think you can excuse that by saying that's not really the point of the movie. And
no, the greater point there is his grandmother's trying to kill him.
Yes.
That's the most important thing.
And there's nobody he can trust, and he's trying to find his middle way, which I thought was another brilliant conceit. That this kid's like, I cannot trust the cops to protect me. Because, you know, and that's the other thing I really love is seeing, because that's not something you really get in a Guy Ritchie film. That's like criminal on criminal violence. It's not like, you know, corrupt cops and all that stuff. I like that it's not just America where cops can fabricate evidence and shoot people on sight. And like, you know, there's not any of these complexities of race and all that. It's just straight up, you know, cops and robbers blasting each other in the street.
So
I think that's interesting.
It is, definitely. And it's like, it provides an ambiguity to kind of the good guy, bad guy thing that the whole film has, really, right? Well, plus, the whole film is ambiguous.
And I think casting Guy Pearce in the role of the quote-unquote good cop was brilliant because, like, I'm probably 75% through the movie before I really understand if he's a good guy or a bad guy.
Yeah.
Like, there was a particular scene of him chilling with his family, and I remember he had a kid that his kid has Down syndrome, and I'm like, okay, he must be good. He's the one good cop on the Melbourne cop force,
and he is,
police force. You know. But he's the type of guy who can play heroic and villainous, and he's done both in his career, and anti-hero. So it's like, you know, he's kind of, you know, Hugo Weaving. I guess.
Yeah.
Is this the same? The Mule that we did a short silent film on? Mm-hmm. Is this kind of in the same genre of true Aussie crime?
Like, as far as ambiguity,
because
goes,
there you had,
like,
cops doing a bunch of shady shit. That was based on a true story.
You did. And you had bad cops who were just trying to do good.
Yeah.
Like, using less than perfect means, like, tools that shouldn't be in a cop's arsenal.
Right.
To affect positive change or arguably, catch a criminal.
Arguably.
Yeah, yeah. And then you had just plain up dirty cops who looked like they were good. And
I think, again, you cast Hugo Weaving in a role in that saying, like, this guy could be Lord Elrond or he could be Agent Smith.
Yeah.
And you're not going to find out until the end of the movie, perhaps. And I think that's really smart casting, because I really wasn't sure, like, man, Jay, should you, like, that's like, throughout the film, I'm debating, like, should you go to the cops? Should you carry this weight like a man? What is the best? Like, when the lawyer was giving him that speech midway through the movie, I'm like, of course that's what you do.
Don't say anything.
But then his uncle Pope, which we need to talk about.
Oh God, we need to talk about Ben Mendelsohn.
You knew about this going in because you'd watched Bloodlines on Netflix.
Uh-huh. And he plays a similarly disturbed character, I would say.
I was not prepared for... I don't think I've ever seen this kind of level of villainy before.
It's so understated, right? It's like, normally when you see some kind of psychopath or sociopath, it's blatant and it's on their face at all times and it's in their eyes. But
I mean, there's a little bit of the paranoia you see from like an Avon Barksdale or a Marlowe, Stanfield from The Wire, but there's also just an unhinged quality where, like, you know, and they do so many great things, like the fact that he's kind of perving on Jay's girlfriend, Nikki, and he carries her into his bedroom.
Man, what a scene.
And then they echo that back after he smothers her.
Mm-hmm.
And he carries her to, like, I don't know what he just threw in the garbage or what. Like, he's not a great...
I don't know.
He's not a great criminal.
No, it doesn't seem like
Pope it. Seems like the guy... Like, I feel like this family was fucked as soon as the Baz character, who was... You've seen this guy... Tons of things.
Joel Edgerton, yeah.
Yeah, the thing that I finally remembered him from was he played a role in Baz Luhrmann's remake of The Great Gatsby.
Ah, yeah, I went through his IMDb, and apparently he's Uncle Owen.
Uncle Owen in from the prequels. A much chubbier face, Uncle Owen.
So that's where I recognized his face from, but I couldn't place
it. He was
it.
In the Warrior film, the box or MMA film with, I've drawn a blank on the guy who plays Bane, Tom Hardy. So he's been in a lot of stuff and you will recognize his face, but when he dies, which is a very abruptly and your first heads up to, hey, the cops are dirty in this film. I feel like that's when the family got flushed down the toilet.
Yeah. He was, you know, he's talking to Pope saying, hey, you should get out of this stuff. You can get into the stock market. Mm. And, you know, as kind of funny and tongue in cheek as that scene is, it gives you a very good indication of who he is and what he wants. And I think
he's the smart one.
He is the smart one. His brother, Craig, I think is his name, is just crazy. He's out there doing drugs.
Well, so did you get the fact that he's not a brother? He's the only non-family member?
Right. Yeah, yeah. Baz is the only friend of the family.
Right. So like Pope is a psycho and kind of an idiot and he's paranoid. Craig is a goofball. And Danny, is that the youngest
Darren.
One? Darren. He is just a baby-faced follower. Yeah. He's like...
He doesn't want any part of this necessarily, but he goes along to get along.
He goes along to get along, and it does not really work for him. I thought that the family was screwed. The other thing I want to talk about is the performance of the grandma, Smurf.
Yeah.
What's her name?
Jackie Weaver.
Like, I haven't seen a criminal matriarch like this since like Mags Bennett season 2 Justified.
Yeah, she's real good.
She's incredible, and she starts off like you just think she's oblivious. She's like one of those mothers that like kisses her boys full on the lips inappropriate.
Yeah,
like,
it's bordering on very inappropriate.
Yeah, I'm like, what is the deal with having like you know, we just got this with True Detective season 2. We got it with the early goings of Boardwalk Empire. Like these mothers having sex, their sexual relations with their kids, man.
We've got a fucked up audience, man. They like this stuff.
No, I mean, I'm saying like that's just in the culture. Latin incest seems like the new kind of just like if we want to go unhinged, we're just going to have mothers fucking sons and daughters fucking
it's effective.
Fathers and
it creeps people out. So.
It certainly does.
So I read, or sorry, I didn't read. I watched an interview with Jackie Weaver where she was talking about this. kind of tangentially. And she said that this is, so first of all, the thing you need to know is that all of these brothers are from different fathers, which I didn't get from the movie, but yeah, that's what she says in the interview.
And they all have a different look too.
They do. Yeah. They're all very different looking. But she says that she's never really had, her character has never really had like a normal, healthy adult relationship with a man. And so the boys are kind of a replacement for that. Like not 100%, not sexually necessarily, but just
little echoes
affectionately, you know, yeah. She desires that affection that she can't get anywhere else. And it comes across as a little creepy.
Yeah. But no, she starts off kind of like, you're just thinking, she's completely in denial about what her boys are getting up to. And then by the end, you realize she's the goddamn devil.
Yeah, she's the madam. You know?
She is the devil, man. And that's like, I think I actually realized that she was completely insane when she talks about the last time she saw Jay's mom. Mm-hmm. That they were fighting over a game of 500, the card game. Mm-hmm. And she started this argument with their daughter because she was trying to play Joker in a no Trump hand, which whatever.
Uh-huh.
And that was like, that's it. You know, that's why you don't speak to your daughter.
I've had similar experiences with my dad.
Sure.
Where, you know, you get into heated arguments during a game.
Sure.
They don't end relationships necessarily.
Sure. Yeah. Especially when you find out that their, you know, daughter's, you're involved in heroin and she's got the son and, you know, they're, And there's the other thing, like this first scene of the movie where you see this kid sitting next to this, his mother, you guess, on the couch, just looks like she's dozed off and they're watching. And you find out that, no, actually, she overdosed on heroin and he called the paramedics and he's just waiting for them to show up. And they're playing the show's showing Let's Make a Deal, the Australian version. I thought that was, in retrospect, a really great framing device because this family essentially has played one suitcase too many. Okay, if they'd stopped at one suitcase.
Oh, is it Deal or No Deal? Is that?
I thought it's Let's Make a Deal. That's one you
got
all.
Isn't that the three doors and you?
Oh, is that it? Deal or No Deal? Okay, it's the one with the 20 suitcases.
I think it's Deal or No Deal. It's, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, they're watching that, and I thought that was interesting because even on, you know, you don't know it because it's the first 5 minutes of the film, but they're talking about like, you know, that's a lot of money. Are you sure you want? And there's, you know, she of course pushes ahead like they always do, and they lose everything.
Yeah, that opening scene is super effective for setting up Jay, I feel. Like, you know, he's... you can just imagine the life he's had. If this is where it ended, imagine the journey. And that, to me, sums up Jay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, I mean... because at the early goings, it's like, okay... his mother was a heroin addict and died of an overdose right in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
His family looks like they're criminals, but kind of the criminals that, you know, there's this mention of the Uncle Pope and he might be a scary figure, but I actually liked all the guys. I thought a lot of this stuff was, you know, kind of feel good criminal type of thing. Like, okay, you know, they've robbed banks or whatever, but you know, they haven't really hurt anybody. And, they seem like they get along in kind of a roughhousing, you know, family kind of dynamic way. And I felt like, okay, well, I'm going to see Jay turn into like, you know, a Michael Corleone second generation criminal type mold. And maybe I did.
Maybe you did.
Because
I'm not sure. I want to talk about the end near the end, but I have a lot of questions about that.
Well, Tim also, I think, because he sent us some pre-feedback and he talks about that stuff too. But it's interesting to see him like fall in love with a girlfriend for the first time and all that stuff felt real. Like the first time you taste like love and get that into your hormone system and how heightened that it is. And then you've got this criminal enterprise to go with it. And you know, the whole time this kid is just trying to do what he thinks is the right thing given the circumstances he's in. And again, you got to keep in mind his thing where he says, this is where I was, this is what I was doing. He's not really a criminal. He's not a bad guy. He's not a good guy. He's just being formed by all these things.
Yeah.
And I guess
and it seems like maybe at the end he comes out with an opinion one way or another, but we'll get there. I did want to mention quickly that this is based on a real story.
Get the fuck out of
true
here,
story.
Really?
Yeah, that happened in Australia. It's called the Walsh Street Killings. If you go look it up, it's almost exactly identical to the plot of this film.
Wow.
Which is you know, police went and killed some people in underworld crime family. They set up this exact operation on him where they left a car in the middle of the street. Cops show up and they kill him. That sort of thing.
I mean, so you're saying that this new wave Aussie crime drama thing that I'm talking about is essentially just Aussie version of Cops. Like, they could just set up they could just get a film crew to do this and boom, it plays. That's kind of incredible. That was my first real sense that this family is crazy.
Like, what's that with the setup for the cops?
Like, okay, there's a crooked brand of narcos or, you know, major crimes units that's running around and busting people. So your act of retribution is to get two just random patrol officers and brutally murder them.
Yeah, indiscriminate revenge.
Yeah, that's insane. And it did nothing except for bring more heat on you.
Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do? Take out the whole police force?
I mean, that's the other thing. Like, there wasn't a lot of connections made between that. And I thought it was a little convenient that Guy Pearce showed up and, like, you know, hey, we're arresting everybody, you know, because we suspect you had something to do with this.
Yeah. So I'm not sure about that either. That seemed a little suspect.
On the other hand, we also knew that they had wiretaps on this family, and not just on this family, but like on second and third layers of the family.
Yeah.
So maybe that made more sense. Like, if they've been hearing their phone conversations throughout the movie, or they've been listening to things that they thought were private conversations. In fact, now that I think about it, that's the obvious answer. They just had their houses and their cars and their phone lines all bugged, and they were just building a case against these people.
Yeah. And maybe that can be used as evidence for the case that this family is bigger than,
because how else would they know that, like, Baz was meeting Pope that one day?
Yeah.
They had to have some inside information. So yeah, that actually makes sense now.
Yeah. And when you combine, you know, the wiretaps, the bugs with, you know, the idea that they're being hunted and that armed robbery is being especially pursued, it feels maybe like these people are more important than we give them credit for.
But it's weird because you get a little of that with Goodfellas, that they're like, you know, these gangsters are living in just kind of like shitty tract housing.
Okay.
But they're flashy, you know, they got nice cars, they got nice clothes. The Corleones, they live in these mansions, and there's like obvious trappings of power in Scarface. I mean, my God,
every fucking
MTV Cribs episode is based on what you see in the film. Uh-huh. These guys are living in shitty tract housing, but they're just wearing, like, you know, Motley Crue t-shirts and jeans, and they're just like, there is no obvious signs of any real power or money there, other than Baz, who's got, you know, money in the stock market that he's stacking up because he's, again, the smart one. But yeah, there's a lot of these. The film just expects you to swallow its assumptions and go along with it to have a good time. And I guess if you don't, or you have trouble picking up those assumptions, or again, if you do not connect with the performance of the Freshville character, Jay, then you're probably not going to enjoy this film. But if you can, I'm not going to say look past, because I don't think they're flaws.
No, if they engage you, it's
so much as if you pick up these lines that they're putting down, then, you know, it's incredible. And the more I'm talking about it, it's like, this film doesn't seem like I don't feel like I'm describing a film that's like just this intense, cerebral, psychological, watchable flick. But it is like I'm doing a disservice to this film somehow.
Well, OK, so let's talk a little bit more about what we liked and less about the plot necessarily.
Okay.
Like, the way it develops its characters is super efficient and very understated. You know, like there's a moment where they're talking about Pope. Like, I don't even think we've been introduced necessarily.
Yeah, Pope is a mystery for like the first 30 minutes of the film. And every time a new face, we're like, we are both like, is this Pope? Is this Pope?
Yeah, you start hearing about Pope and he gets this reputation even before he's on screen.
And then we finally met Pope. We debated whether that was Pope or not, because it's like, okay.
and then, so there's a line where he's talking with, what's her name? Smurf. I'll just call her that.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, oh, are you off your meds? Have you been taking your meds or something like that? Mm-hmm. And that gives you an insight into this character without seeing any of the stuff that you're thinking, right? So, like, you get an idea that, okay, he has this history of mental illness, maybe. He's a little unhinged.
Yeah, it adds
a
whole
crazy
Sopranos level. Like, this guy went to therapy, and he saw a psychologist, and they prescribed him medication, and
and you really start getting a texture to that character that you're never shown. Yeah. It's just a one-off comment that isn't even necessarily about the history of that character, which I really like, and the subtlety of everything, and kind of the ambiguity helps too, you know, when you, mm-hmm. when you see stuff like him carrying that girl, Nikki, into the bedroom and just standing there looking at her. What is he thinking? What is he going to do there if Jay doesn't walk in?
Right. Nothing good, I don't think.
I can't imagine it would be anything good.
Yeah.
Anything that she would like, but those questions are super important. And I feel like that's the thing that I love about this movie is both that moment there. There's another moment at the end where he's hugging his grandmother that you also have similar questions, right after he kills Pope.
Sure.
And I keep, whenever I hear the name Pope, I keep thinking of Pope from Falling Skies, and it's really screwing with me.
Not as much gravitas with that Pope.
No, not as much God, intensity. No. Do you want to talk about the end? Should we go there yet?
Let's read Tim's comments, and then we can start talking about it, because he's got like three paragraphs, and then we can, I don't want to step on his toes, but
okay.
He's going to usher us into the end game here. It goes, what I recall from the film is a real sense of growing tension and dread. From the moment Baz is killed, it's like a powder keg. This is personified in the character of Pope. Pope isn't physically intimidating, but he is one scary dude. He's intense, paranoid, manipulative, and just fucking creepy. Did you find that?
Oh, yeah.
What's he thinking as he's watching and listening to Air Supply? Is the song even registering in his mind? You know, that's the thing. Like, I often wonder what it's like to go into the mind of a really paranoid person, because these thoughts are not logical.
Mm-hmm.
But when you live in a world where you are being bugged, etc.,
yeah,
what is the lines between what's logical and what is, you know, normal precaution and what's not kind of get mm-hmm. blurred. So, you
that,
know,
that idea that, you know, you're, it's not paranoia if they're really out to get
well,
you.
Well, would you go to the mental illness angle if it wasn't for that conversation with his mother?
No, probably not.
That's interesting because, like, as portrayed, most of the big gangsters kind of are mentally ill, especially Hendry from Goodfellas. I mean, by the end of that movie, he's a fucking mess. He's yeah. a lunatic.
Yeah.
In fact, I've seen that movie like a half a dozen times. I still don't know were that helicopter real? Were they really out to get him? Or like, you know, it's like when they flushed the drugs, was that something they had to do? Or that conversation kind of frames us thinking that he's just like the bad seed in the family. But then again, his mother is clearly, I think, nuts.
Yeah. And I'm trying to figure out how much,
especially the way it's like, she's got the Reba McEntire, like wide eyes and like the,
oh yeah,
like the chilling, almost mask-like smile when and she's
the painted on expression, like the constant painted on expression of surprise and or something else. There's something menacing about those eyebrows that I can't quite put my finger on.
The fact that they're painted on. She's, I mean, I draw a lot of comparisons to Mags Bennett, but Mags Bennett always seemed like this ruthless intelligence.
Yeah.
Whereas Smurf, not certainly ruthless and more intelligent than you'd think, but it's more like an Animal Kingdom thing. It's more of an animal, like mama cub, like,
yeah,
this stuff comes because she's a she-bear looking after her just, you know, monstrous cubs.
Yeah, I get the impression that she wouldn't have been in this life of crime if not for the criminal nature of her
kids. You know, that's what it is. Mags was aware that her sons were a bunch of disappointing fuck-ups, that she is going to have to eventually die and leave this family to this decrepit state, whereas Smurf is in complete denial about how worthless her children are.
Yeah, she kind of lets the idea of family cloud her judgment a little bit.
Yeah.
But is very protective.
He goes on, Tim does, I find the movie makes great use of dull and mundane everyday aspects of suburban life. I'm thinking of the game show on TV at the start, Janine dunking her tea bag, which that's Smurf we've been referring to her, and Josh scraping his toast. The nightmare world of this family is just as routine. True enough. I also saw Pope as the rogue cub who threatened the survival of the pack with his reckless leadership. Unless another cub stepped up and took him out, he'd bring them all down. After that happened, what's next? With Pope out of the way, does the family go straight, or does Josh take over and continue down the criminal path? It's a tough question. I think it's left open-ended. My hunch is that Josh and Darren are more likely to go straight. So one of the things I thought from the end of the film was I'm not so sure that Josh wasn't giving Smurf the old Marcus Aurelius.
Oh, no.
Gladiator treatment.
Uh-huh.
Like that hug, it seemed like it could just as easily be a smother. And the way she was holding her hands at the end, like the way that when it cuts to black, I feel like, you know, Inception, where it's like, you know, it cuts to black just as the top is starting to wobble.
Yeah.
And there's a debate about whether, you know, was she about to start to struggle? Was she about to lose consciousness? Something about that. I don't know, because I feel like she is the root. Like, there's no way he can get away with blowing Pope's brains out and their home with her still alive.
I'm really struggling with the end of this as far as what I think is going on.
Because Pope sits down and says, well, it's a crazy fucking world or something to that effect.
Gets blown
gets
away.
Gets his brains blown, which was genuinely shocking.
It was. Because you don't see the gun.
No.
You don't see the movement toward the gun. Nothing.
No, but I was also shocked that Jay was just going to go back to his family. I'm like, because, you know, that's the brilliant thing that they play here, where Josh calls this audible, that you find out the twist as it's happening, where he's like, I'm going to meet with my family, and I'm going to find a way to give testimony that will satisfy the system. I'm going to tell them everything they want to hear, but I'm going to forearm the defense so that they have an easy answer for everything, and they're going to get my uncles off. Legally, not sexually. Although a Smurf on the table, you never never know.
Sure.
So I'm right so far, right? But then when he goes back to live with his family, I'm like, this seems like a bad idea.
So the bad idea part, I agree. The bad idea part comes from her trying to kill him just scenes earlier, right?
Yeah.
Sending in a hit squad to witness protection to try to take him out.
Yeah.
How much is family an important factor for her? How much is survival of the fittest a factor for her, right? Like, is this hug, her very normal everyday reaction to seeing family, this hug, is that menacing? Is that accepting him back into the family? Is that a way of asking for forgiveness? I mean, what is that hug?
Man, I don't know.
And seeing, I guess, Darren's lack of reaction in this scene is interesting as well. I mean, obviously, we know he doesn't really want any part of this crime stuff. He's just going along. But him not reacting, he does this a couple times. When Nicole is being smothered or injected, he's like, no, Danny, Pope, why are you killing her, mate? Pope, why are you killing her?
Pope, what are you doing?
You ain't got to kill her.
Yeah, no. And then
and he's just sitting there on the couch watching it happen.
Then we just start smothering her. It's like the same thing. Like, you know, again, he doesn't have this presence of, I mean, he's physically bigger. He could crush Pope without a problem.
Sure.
But he's mentally and emotionally and leadership wise.
More stable, more capable. Yes.
But I'm talking about, no, he, from a leadership and emotional strength standpoint, he's a weakling. He's the baby of the family in every sense of the word.
I feel like he's got his head on more straight than Pope, though.
But a person with head on straight would go up there and smash Pope before he does that. But,
sure, he should definitely do that. And he knows he should do that.
But that's the thing, like, so
he doesn't do it.
So if Jay kills Pope.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say he kills Smurf. Or let's say he doesn't. Then what?
Okay.
Like, if he goes straight, he's still got a dead body with its brain splattered out in the room. And he's also, you think the cops are not going to be like, you know, these crooked cops are not going to be like, oh, well, the family got away from us once again. Those Duke boys, coo, 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 you know, like, this isn't Boss Hogg. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like this family still got a target on their back. Is killing Pope enough? Like, do they look the other way?
That's a good question.
I mean, Jay's still a minor.
Mm-hmm.
We know that
the one they were really after was Pope, right?
What does Guy Pierce think about that? If he, like, you know, would say, hey, I just killed my uncle because my uncle tried to kill me.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine there would be some consequence to pay if they knew that for Jay.
So that's the thing. Like, I feel like he had to kill his uncle Pope because there's no way you could ever trust. Like, the next time this Pope figure felt a little bit of police heat on him, which I think is inevitable since we're dealing with the crooked cop department and they're not just going to give up, then Jay's going to be right back on the chopping block.
Yeah. The other question is, why did he kill Pope? Is it totally out of revenge for killing his girlfriend? Is it to protect the rest of his family who he sees as less involved?
I think it's the Reese's peanut butter cup.
It's both of them?
I have both of them, and they go great together. It's revenge for the brutal way that he treated his girlfriend. And also of himself, because he tried to kill Jay at least twice. Then it's also protection. Like, I'm never going to live in fear of you anymore. And that's the other thing. Like, so let's say he doesn't smother Smurf. Mm-hmm. One way that Smurf could look at this is, if I let Pope, if Jay hadn't killed Pope, it's just a matter of time before Darren, my baby, gets put on the chopping block. And I think she's rational enough to see that.
I think so too. That's where I go, is this is kind of going to be water under the bridge.
But she's also kind of unhinged, so that, like, even if she's like, I appreciate what you did for Darren, baby, but I'm still going to knife you in your sleep one of these days, because you have to answer for the death of Pope.
But she's also all about her family, right? Like, there are so many conflicting ideas in here that give you... I don't know if they're necessarily conflicting, but they're interesting points of view. The idea that she would try to kill Jay to preserve her own freedom, her own or her children's safety and freedom.
Yeah.
And then the idea of how important her children are to her. Like, how much does that extend to Jay as a grandson?
Plus the criminal mindset of, like, even if something like how many times you see Michael Corleone say, that's a smart play, that's the good play, that's the play I would have made if I was that guy. Mm-hmm. I'm still going to kill him, because to do otherwise is to invite the accusation of weakness, which is fatal in this game. And I feel like Smurf kind of rolled that old school by the end of the movie too.
Yeah, I felt like the family was out of the crime business at the end. I mean, there is basically no family left. It's, well, that's Darren who wants no part of it. It's
but Pope
Smurf who really doesn't
Pope
have the means for it.
Absolutely would have continued doing some kind of thing. Because 100%. Because even Baz is like, look, man, you take your money you got and you invest it in the stock market. And I thought maybe one of the things was going to be a kind of commentary on the economy, that Baz was going to lose everything, all right?
And have to go back to the life of crime.
Yes, like that's like this is the last heist. This is the, you know, this is the infamous last heist after your last heist, because your 401k tanked.
Yeah, gotcha.
You know, but it didn't go that way. But, you know, it's like I'm saying, like, that's something he trusted and respected and was saying, look, you don't have to do this anymore. And he's essentially said, F you. In fact, Pope is so hard to get a read on this movie. I spent the next 30 minutes thinking, he gave Baz up to the cops. He is actually some kind of double informant agent. There was that whole thread, because he had the really weird reaction to that.
I don't know that there's anything that says he didn't.
Well, frankly, when he posse'd everybody up to kill the two the cops, it's killing, like, that seems... Then again, if the guy's just crazy and paranoid and he forgot what side he's working on... I mean, you can't say definitively, and I think that's kind of cool, because when you watch this a second time, you start pondering those questions all over again, and it's one of the rare films I thought held up to that. Like, okay, when I'm going through, you know, the second time I saw Inception, I felt like I don't need to see this again to answer any more questions. I had some questions, I had some things I was fuzzy on, I got those cleared up, I know exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Not to take anything away from that movie. This one, like, the questions I had, still, like, yeah, I can see it from that angle. Well, maybe I could, you know, I still, like, maybe Jay did kill Smurf. Maybe Pope was working for the cops at some point, and he just lost track of the game he was playing.
I think that's where those character ambiguities make this a more interesting film.
Yeah.
If you had very defined motives for everyone and you knew what they were thinking at all times, it wouldn't be nearly as interesting.
Yeah.
And so the idea that you can question, oh, well, what is Smurf going to do next at the very end of this film, I think is a bonus. It's a plus for this film.
Yeah.
And I have a very clear idea that Jay has solved the family's problem by killing Pope, and now this family is going to try to survive in another way that is not crime-related, is not armed robberies.
Yeah, it's weird because, like...
But I could see it another way. You don't... Like, you could probably come up with an argument that would convince me of another possible outcome.
Yeah. I also thought that, you know, again, I think this movie has got a pretty special first watch impact.
Mm-hmm.
And largely, like, you know, things that were tense as hell the first time you watched, like the major crimes unit, you know, getting the drop on the witness protection unit and like them debating and not knowing whether all these officers are going to get shot, whether Jay's going to get shot, what's going to happen. That wasn't as intense. And obviously the twist that they have in the end where, you know, Jay kind of turns state's witness, but with a twist. And then when he ends up killing Pope, those things, but like Nikki's execution still was really gripping and intense for me.
Yeah. Yeah, you watched it twice? I didn't get to watch it twice.
Yeah, I did. Okay. There's a lot of things that still work, and I think it definitely rewards multiple watches, but it's one of those things where, like, this is one of the very rare occasions where you can't really put the genie back in a bottle. If you read, like, a very dry description of this plot, you're going to rob yourself of some really great cinematic moments. I hope everyone listening to this didn't do that.
Yeah, I hope so, too. I mean, that said, you know, the film is kind of carried on the back of the actors, I feel. There's nothing particularly spectacular about the plot. It's just the way that people portray these characters.
No, but like if you know Smurf is going to be what she is at the end from the beginning, it takes a little bit of the magic act away.
Yes.
And also I think like I can still see that on multiple watches, but if you never got that initial watch, I think – you know, some of these performances are, you know, it's the writing and the direction and also. But yeah, a lot of the performances I don't think would work as well if you just knew everything to go in, and but you didn't get the art to go with it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you just read the synopsis.
Sure.
So, yeah, don't do that. I hope people didn't.
All right. I've got a pretty tough question for you.
Okay.
I want to know, as far as like the pantheon of crime films, if you were to put this up in the gallery, where does this stick?
Wow.
I've thought about this for a little bit.
Well, it's not going to dethrone The Godfather I've seen that like 50 times and I can watch another 50 times. And I don't know why I don't get bored watching The Godfather. It's like, I feel like when I look at watch The Godfather, I'm looking at a really great painting and I can, you know, dig at new details every single time I do it. It's not as good as like Goodfellas or even Casino.
See, okay.
But Casino, so you're starting to get close.
You're getting real close. So in my notes, I have, we just recently watched A History of Violence, better than A History of Violence.
Okay, certainly. Sure.
Well, I also have not quite.
That's also in the same vein that it's more of a psychological look at film than a, you know, than a very plot, like, you know, Godfather is driven by plot and performances, where History of Violence in this film is driven by psychology and performances.
Yeah, I don't know. I just didn't enjoy it as much as this. I also have not quite as good as Goodfellas. Not quite. Goodfellas is a very different movie, but it's excellent in what it does.
Plus, just De Niro and Pesci just elevate that. There's star wad. I mean, there's star power. Like, I'm trying to think if you throw, I don't know, Hugh Jackman in this or something, or, you know,
Hugh Jackman.
No, he's still
with or without claws. Because all I can think of is Wolverine.
I mean, back in the day of when Pesci and De Niro gave a shit, they were just really,
yeah. Like, look at like. As far as like Casino, look at De Niro in like The Untouchables. Uh-huh. I mean, he's outstanding in that movie.
Yeah.
And he's great in Casino, but like Casino is where I start to go, okay, it's a different type of movie, but it's about as good.
I think
like
Casino's, or, the other thing is Casino's too long.
That's my
crack on Casino the movie is that.
Yeah, that's well over 2 hours, right?
It's a great film. And it looks amazing. It's got great performances, but I felt it didn't warrant the almost 3 hour running time.
Yeah. And then I look at stuff like a little more recent, like The Departed, and I go, this is about as good as The Departed.
I think this is better than The Departed.
I think The Departed is a little too over the top in its performances.
Yeah, like
whereas
Nicholson,
this is so much more understated. Yeah,
I
feel
think,
real bad saying that, but Nicholson is kind of a detractor.
And then when I remember when that movie came out, and I remember everybody, there's a lot of people like praising his performance, and I'm like, I don't know. Like, I'm not saying anything bad about Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
But like, you know, it's like comparing giving Brando a blowjob in The Island of Dr. Moreau. It's like, no, this is Not that anyone did. Not that was a terrible film. But yeah, this is this is him to, like, you know, to this bloated, mugging, rubber face extent. And I'm talking equally about Jack Nicholson and
sure.
And his accent work. Oh my God. Yeah, Jack Nicholson's accent in Departed.
It's real bad. And I feel bad, you know, giving it giving this the nod over The Departed or maybe even Casino, because, like, the actors in those are so good.
But the actors in this general, are really good.
Yeah, but I mean, like, in general, I don't feel like those were their best performances. I've definitely seen better work from DiCaprio.
Sure.
I've definitely seen better work from Alec Baldwin. Like,
sure.
So I have to say this is slightly better than The Departed, and maybe just as good as Casino.
Well, here's the thing. Ben Mendelsohn eats Jack Nicholson's lunch.
Oh,
if you're if you're stacking up, you know, kind of like guys who you're not sure how to feel about and are scary individuals, like, you know. And again, Jack Nicholson on his best day in his best film blows Mendelsohn out of the water. But here,
The Shining, one of my all-time favorite films, and he's incredible.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, no, that's the what elevates to me. So yeah, I think we're finding its level. It's better. I found it more engrossing. Like, because that's the thing. Like, you know, your watchability factor. Its watchability is higher than Casino.
I think so.
And higher than Departed, but not quite the Goodfellas or certainly the God. The Godfather is another level above all.
I mean, Scarface is up there with the Godfather. It's like,
it's not. Yeah, okay, I'll go with that.
I mean, I'm not going to say it's as good as the Godfather.
I think Goodfellas is better than Scarface.
Really? Oh, man. We're going to have to do a top 10 list of, of gangster films.
Gangster films?
At some point,
And then, like, where do you put the Guy Ritchie stuff? The silly,
over the top? I haven't seen much of his stuff. So I've seen
Snatch. You had to have seen Snatch, right?
He's Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, right?
Stock,
okay,
Snatch,
I've seen that.
Rock and Roll.
I've seen parts of Snatch. I haven't actually seen all of Snatch.
They're just a different type of enjoyable movie. It's like, it's not really fair to compare them to these other operatic works.
Yeah, I mean, Lock, Stock is more heisty.
Yeah.
You know, it's not...
It's cool.
A little more tongue-in-cheek,
like,
in
Godfather's
some ways.
Godfather's not cool in the way that, like, the Guy Ritchie films are cool.
No, and this movie is not cool.
No, it is not cool.
It's very uncool. But it's great.
Yep.
So that's kind of where I put it.
That would be an interesting psychological... That'd be an interesting podcasting experiment to do, like, a top 10... Like, just... You know, kind of like we did the top 10 from last year. Just spit them all out on paper and then argue about it.
Sure.
Why not?
Maybe do some live watches of them since we'd have to watch them anyway.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's a 3-hour marathon Casino live watch.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's it. I mean, do you got anything else you want to talk about?
I don't think so. If you haven't seen Bloodline, I'd go watch it. If you like Ben Mendelsohn in this.
It stands
on his performance alone.
If I didn't have Mr. Robot that everybody is currently crucifying us for missing, and someone said on the forums this weekend that Mr. Robot is first season True Detective as far as us missing out an opportunity to catch lightning in a bottle.
You can't do that, though, because you realize if we tried to do that, we'd get far more misses than we ever got hits.
I get it. But also, like, I think there's got to be a middle road, like, 3 or 4 episodes in, we're like, you know, bam, we're on the scene. I don't know how to do that, but, you know, for the right, like, I wish we'd done it for True Detective. Like, if we started doing that episode 3 and caught episode 4, like, oh, man, I'd felt so good. But and Humans is the other one that is getting a lot of buzz. So it's like, I don't really want, because I feel like Bloodlines is come and gone as far as a hype perspective. And maybe I can still get in and capture the zeitgeist of a Mr. Robot or Humans. But
yeah, I mean, there'll be more seasons of Bloodline, certainly. We can catch up later.
But yeah, thanks to Tim Michael for commissioning. You have much to be proud of, Australia, for this film.
Yeah.
It's like I said, I feel like between this and Holy Smoke, we did the two best Australian films
ever made.
We've had the Aussie double feature. So thanks for turning us on to that. Again, if you would like to find out how you can commission your very own podcast, make us watch something. Maybe it's good. Maybe it's terrible. Not many people pulled the terrible option.
Yeah.
They can make us watch
Mad Max for the double whammy. Terrible Australian movie.
The original.
Yes,
the original.
Obviously, yeah.
Although a lot of people liked that. A lot of people
fucking hated it, man.
It might have been you had to be there at the time.
I think so.
Because the budget problems of that are just a little Mm-hmm. Little hard at look past. But if you'd like to find out how you can commission your very own commission podcast, go to baldmove.com/shop. And there it is.
Yeah,
there it is.
Click on big fat film reel.
Click on the big fat film reel, and we will watch 2-ish hours of any movie or television show you'd like, and give you our opinion on it, good, bad, or ugly.